Okay, is there a way to get it just so it pulls? Yeah. Wow, this is going to be, this is great. Great. There's probably no way to mute it. Is there real quick? That's all right. We'll just leave it up there. That's no problem, really. Oh, so how do I get it back?
No, hold on.
What did you click there?
My bad. I just jiggled the cord.
Okay.
That's what I did. You want the screen to go black. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Daniel. As in no sound or as in
just
no
to have it off right now. Oh, sure. But if it doesn't.
Sure.
We just power it down.
Let me do
it.
Okay, so.
Function F4.
Function.
This is how you do dual screens.
Mm-hmm. The which button?
Like,
button? B? Really?
B for like, blank. Yeah.
Which
okay.
Which button did you hit?
The just B.
I never knew that. That's great. Thank you.
You are bouncing right now. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't exactly run PowerPoint.
Great.
You're all
don't
good.
Trip over the cord. Thank you so much, Tammy. I appreciate it. Yeah, I'm going to scoot this up a little bit.
Yeah.
All right.
We have a little bit higher one, but it doesn't have a back. So
this is good, right? Oh.
For this side?
Your toes.
Sorry for our ghetto-ness.
Hey, this is awesome. This is great. Okay. Try not to spit on you guys, okay?
Is your last name German?
It is.
Is it?
Yeah. It's funny, it means teacher or master teacher.
Oh, really?
And the first name, my first name, Chad, is Celtic. It means defender. Isn't that funny?
That's funny.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I should say. Seems like morning. I'm on Eastern time still, so I don't know really what time it is anymore, but I'm having a great time nonetheless. Well, thank you all for joining me here this afternoon, and I'm looking forward to having us have some discussion. I'm going to be teaching a little more in depth about this notion of evil and suffering. The official title of this talk is Christian Responses to Evil and Suffering, A Deeper Look. So we're going to explore this in a bit more detail, but I am planning to leave some time for us to dialogue, to have some comments and questions, and that's where things are really lively and fun. So I hope to, I will leave some time, some good time, I hope, for that. How about we begin with a word of prayer? Lord, I thank you for this conference. I thank you for this opportunity to explore these important issues about Christian faith, and I ask that you would please guide our time this afternoon. I pray that it would be fruitful and productive, that we would learn and grow together. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay, so the problem of evil and suffering, a deeper look. What I would like to have us do here this afternoon is a couple of things. First, I want us to look at some distinctions between some different kinds of evil. We'll explore that, what's called natural evil and moral evil. And then I want to look a little bit more deeply at some specific kinds of evil that are distinguished in objections to Christian faith. In particular, I want to look at what's called gratuitous evil. And we looked, if you were at the second session, we touched on that. And also what's called horrendous evil or horrific evil. We're going to look at that. And lots of kinds of evil. And then we're also going to look at a very important question. Where did evil come from? Where did it come from? I mean, if God created everything, then didn't God create evil? So that's where we're headed, and I have a few other topics to address regarding those points as well. and then we'll have some discussion. All right, so first of all, there is a distinction that's helpful to make between what's called natural evil and moral evil. Natural evil and moral evil. So when we look, for example, at the shootings that we've had this past week and the tragedy there, that would be an example, or those would be examples, of what's called moral evil. Moral evil. Moral evil is evil that is done by persons who are intending to accomplish evil. Persons who are intending to accomplish evil. With this kind of evil, free will is involved. I used in the main talk, I used the example of a robotic device that killed a man. He got in the way of the robotic arm and it smashed him, it crushed him. That's not an example of moral evil. There was no maliciousness about it. The robot didn't intend to harm the person. The robot had no free will. The robot had no will at all. So that isn't moral evil. But intentionally killing someone or harming someone, there we have moral evil. Now that's in contrast to what's called natural evil. And natural evil would be like what insurance companies sometimes call acts of God. They used to, now they call them acts of nature. So you may have, for example, an earthquake or a tornado that goes through and destroys, say, houses, and people are in the houses and people get killed. There's no moral evil there. It's not like somebody created the tornado for the intention of killing people. No, it's just a natural occurrence. So, by the way, you guys in the back look awfully comfortable. That's pretty nice, those cozy chairs back there. Yeah. When we're looking at solutions to what's called the problem of evil, and by the way, by this point, you should see that it's not just the problem of evil, there are problems of evil. When looking at solutions to problems of evil, it's important to keep these in mind because some solutions will reach moral kinds of evil, whereas other solutions will address the natural kinds of evil. So, for example, in the main talk, I looked at the free will defense, which was offered by Professor Alvin Plantinga. The free will defense. And there's an extended version of it, which we're going to look at in a bit, or perhaps I should say a different version of the free will defense, which is called a free will theodicy. And a theodicy is different than a defense. A theodicy is a way of explaining how it could be that God could allow evil in the world. Plantinga's free will defense that we looked at was merely just a rebuttal of the logical argument. Remember that? It was just a rebuttal of a logical argument. But a number of people, even some of the early Christians like St. Augustine back in the 4th and 5th century and later Christians, have used this free will idea not just to rebut something, again, that's what Alvin Plantinga did, but they used it in a different way, that is to show how we can explain why God would have a world in which there's evil and suffering. Not just that it's a logical possibility, but rather this is the way God would really want it to be. That's called a free will theodicy. So you can use the free will theodicy, that is, you can use this idea that God created a world with free people because it's better to have free people than to not have free people. You can use that then to explain how it could be that God would have a world like ours in which there's evil. And you can even explain the evil, in some sense, by saying, well, it happened because of the person's free will. So that will account for moral evil, you see. Why did so-and-so kill such-and-such? Well, it was his free choice. We can explain these kinds of evil with free choice, but that, notice, doesn't explain natural evil. The free will theodicy does not explain natural evil, at least at first glance. So how do we explain that? How do we explain, in other words, a world in which we have hurricanes or tsunamis or tornadoes, earthquakes, what have you, in which people get killed or harmed. How can we explain those kinds of evil? Well, again, I would encourage you to go back if you took notes, or if you perhaps want to get the tape, or in my Building Belief book, I go into this as well. I go into some of the explanations that we gave for evil in the talk, and I go into even more. You can look at those and say, okay, here are some ways of giving answers for various kinds of evil. But now what I want to do is focus in a bit on this notion of the natural problem of evil, natural evil. So let's take an example of a situation where we have a tsunami. Can we explain a tsunami in a way in which we can also explain moral evil? Well, at first sight, again, it seems that we can't, because there was no free will involved. However, if we think about it a bit more deeply, we can see that from the Christian perspective, the world is not as it should be, is it? The world is not as it should be. The world isn't the way God originally created it. It's in a fallen state. In the book of Romans, in Romans 5, it puts it something like this: the world is groaning. The world is groaning. Why is it groaning? It's groaning because of the fall of Adam and Eve. This free will theodicy, this free will explanation for why the world could be as it is, have evil in it and so on, and still be there be a good God. This free will theodicy involves the idea, the Christian idea, that God created the world and he created it good, but there was a fall. There was a turning away, an original turning away by human beings and angelic persons. And that turning away from the good created a problem in the universe. There is a cosmic problem we have. The biblical view of the world is that it is not as it should be. The world is not as it should be. There's been a cosmic fall. As a matter of fact, now this is speculation on my part, but I think it's right. Have you heard of the second law of thermodynamics? It's basically the idea that things are running down, right? If you doubt that entropy is flourishing in the universe, just keep watching your face every morning for about the next 25, 35 years, and you'll see entropy happening right there in the mirror. Okay. The amount of usable energy in the universe is collapsing, is decreasing. Entropy is increasing. There are different ways of explaining this. Heat energy is dissipating. Things are falling apart. If you leave an automobile out in the field for 10 years, it's not going to look newer and shinier after 10 years. Right? There's a sort of degradation that's happening in the universe. The second law of thermodynamics. I think the second law of thermodynamics actually is a part of the fall. Again, I couldn't give you any evidence for that, but it just seems to me that the very structure our universe is in now, where things are getting worse and worse, falling apart, energy is dissipating, things are running down, I would submit to you that that's all a part of the fall of the angelic world and the human world. The world is groaning. It's not as it should be. In other words, earthquakes, tsunamis, and so on that kill people wasn't the way God designed it originally. Now, am I saying that the way God created the universe originally did not allow for there to be such things as earthquakes and so on? I don't know about that. But what I'm saying is the world as it is now has not been created in the way that it should be. This is the Christian view, the historic Christian view. It has been for 2,000 years. It's not as the way as it should be. And because of that, it's not just human beings who are affected by the fall because of our choices, but also because of the cosmic curse of the universe because of the fall. There's a cosmic curse. Francis Schaeffer used to call this the sludge of the fall. The sludge of the fall that just keeps rolling on down. This fall of human beings that took place had an effect on human beings, but it also had an effect on the universe, and our own sin throughout the centuries just keeps compounding the problems in many ways, and the sludge of the fall rolls on down throughout the universe, and we're affected by it throughout the centuries. The world is not as it should be. So, in other words, not only do you have moral evil being explained by freedom of the will, you also have natural evil being explained by freedom of the will, because the free will choices of the angelic realm, Lucifer and his minion, for example, and the free choices of Adam and Eve and people all the way down through history, that's all affected not just us as persons in our choices, but it's affected the universe as a whole. And so the very curse of the world, so to speak, has been affected by freedom of the will. Now, again, we have the question before us. How did it originate, though? In other words, Lucifer turned from God. Adam turned from God. Eve turned from God. How do we get that first free will choice to be bad? So that's the problem we're looking at now. So in other words, we could say, okay, we could perhaps explain moral evil by freedom of the will. We could explain even perhaps natural evil by freedom of the will. But we still have the fundamental problem of how somebody who's created good and is given free will could turn and do something bad. Usually when I'm teaching on this, say, at Bethel College, a student will say, well, here's a way of explaining how it is that Adam and Eve could have turned from good, because the devil tempted them. Okay? Lucifer tempted them. That's what happened. He tricked them. Well, that might get us a little ways, but then, of course, what question could we ask? Who tricked Lucifer? Right? I mean, what happened with him? Well, I think we have the same problem with Lucifer as we do with Adam and Eve. I don't think it's a different problem at all. See, I don't think sin is primarily a matter of being tricked. Sin is primarily a matter of turning from God. Turning from God. All right, so we've got Lucifer. We've got Adam and Eve. They're both created good. Lucifer, it seems, I think we can make this inference from the Old and New Testament passages referring to him, that he was created as a beautiful angel, one of the most powerful, probably the most powerful, most beautiful angel of the angelic realm. God didn't create him evil. God created him good. How could a good being then turn from good through free choice and do something evil? Well, I hope you had your Starbucks over the lunch break. So that way you've got the caffeine in your system now, causing those C fibers in your brain to be firing, because we're going to need them all engaged here for a couple of minutes, okay? All the C fibers need to be engaged, just for a couple of minutes, and then we'll let them relax. Okay. Here's a question for you. Now, this is going to seem like I'm clear off the topic, but I'm getting somewhere with this, okay? Who created God? Now, some people get bothered by this because they think, no, wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense, because everything that exists must be created, right? Well, no, not everything that exists necessarily needs to be created. I mean, everything in the universe was created. I mean, atheists and theists agree with that. Everything that's in the universe was created. I mean, think of you. You came from something, right? You came from your parents. Think of a tree. It came from its tree parents. Think of your cat, it came from its cat parents. Think of the sun, Think of the stars, the galaxies, they all came to be from something else. So everything in the universe, everybody agrees, came from somewhere else. Right? I mean, everybody agrees with it. Atheist, everybody. Everything that's in the universe came from somewhere else. The question is, does it follow that since everything came from somewhere else, everything in the universe came from somewhere else, does it follow that everything which exists must have come from somewhere else? Well, of course, this is where Christians say, no, not everything that exists came from something else. As a matter of fact, when we speak of God, what we mean by definition is, part of what we mean is, that God is a being which didn't come from somewhere else. That's just definitionally what we mean by God. It's one of the things we mean by God. God exists as a necessary being. God exists as a necessary being. He didn't come from somewhere else. Now, if you're talking to somebody who doesn't believe in God, they should at least grant you that you can have that definition. That's what we mean by God, at least. God is a being who didn't come to be from somewhere else. By definition, we mean God is the necessary being. He could not not be. That's what we mean. Everything in our physical universe came to be. Everything's what's called contingent. It came to be from something else. But God, by definition, is a necessary being. Okay, so you get the point, right? So when we talk about God, to ask the question then, well, who created God, is a ridiculous question if what you mean by God is the being that didn't come from anywhere. Right? So if what you mean by God exists as a necessary being, that is, he doesn't have to come from somebody else's, from somewhere else. As a matter of fact, he doesn't come from somewhere else, because what I mean by God is the being who never came to be from something else. He just always was. If that's what you mean, then asking the question, where did he come from, is a ridiculous question. He's the uncaused cause. He's the necessary being. There wasn't something else that caused him to be. Right? Okay, so again, this seems like a tangential point, but it's not. Because on the free will defense that we're talking about now, looking at how Lucifer or Adam and Eve could have chosen to do evil, we're going to have a similar issue here. Okay, are the sea fibers still firing up there? Okay, we've got to keep them going for a couple more minutes. Because by definition, you see, when I freely choose to do something, then it makes no sense to ask the question, but what caused me to make that choice? I caused myself to make the choice. But what caused me to make myself to? Nothing. Okay? Nothing. That's like asking who caused God to exist. No. What causes you to make a free will decision to do something? You cause yourself to make the free will. But what caused you to cause yourself? Nothing. That's what it means to have free will. There are very few of these kinds of things. I mean, God's existence is one. Nothing caused God to be. What caused you to freely choose to do something? You caused you to freely. But what caused you to cause you to do? Nothing. That's the end of the question. So, what caused Lucifer to turn against God? Lucifer caused Lucifer. But what caused Lucifer to cause Lucifer to turn against God? Nothing. Except he did. That's what it means to have free will. You can be your own first cause, so to speak. You are the cause of your choices, and nothing is causing you to cause your choices. Okay. Let's take a breather for a second. We're going to kick these back in again. Now, there's a difference, and this is a very important, this is a philosophical distinction, but it's a very important one to keep in mind. There's a difference between reasons for something's happening and causes for something's happening. Reasons and causes are very different. So, for example, I have this I have this marker here, and the marker is now up in the air, and it just dropped to the floor. Okay, now I could ask the question, what caused the marker to drop to the floor? What caused it to drop to the floor? Well, I could start giving you an explanation, and this explanation could get rather complex rather quickly, right? So I could speak about the moving of my fingers away from the marker. I could talk about the force of gravity, which is pulling the marker down. I could give you those kinds of explanations in terms of the causes of the marker going to the ground. Now, what if I do this? Okay, so now, what caused me to throw the marker? To have Heidi catch it? Now let's think about this for a minute. What caused me to throw the marker? Yeah, now look, there's a couple different ways we could go here. We could start talking about causes. And I could say, well, there was the event that happened in my brain of a thought of throwing it to Heidi. There was the activity, the neural activity in the brain, which caused, say, the nerves to cause my arm to respond in a certain way and throw the marker. And I could go through that, that explanation of causes. But there's something else that would be missing if my explanation of why I threw the marker just involved those causes. There'd be something else missing. The missing part would be the reason I threw the marker. The reason. What was the reason I threw the marker? The reason I threw the marker is because I wanted to make a point. I wanted to make a point, and I freely chose to throw the marker. Now notice, I could have freely chosen to not throw the marker, but rather to go write some story on the board. Or I could have chosen countless other ways of making the same example here, right? But what did I do? I freely chose to use this as an example. Okay, now hang with me because we're almost to the conclusion here. I chose to use throwing the marker to Heidi as an example. I chose to do that. Why did I do it? I just told you why. Because I chose to use that as a reason. But wait, why didn't I use some other example? Why didn't I come over here to the board and start writing on the board? Why didn't I do that? Because I chose to use this. That's my reason. Ah, but what caused you to use that reason? I did. But what caused me to cause me to do that? Nothing. Do you see the point here? The point is there's a stopping point when it comes to free will, where it's ridiculous to keep asking the question because it comes to an end. That's what it means to have free will. It's the same thing about God. So what caused this? Well, God caused that. Okay, well, what caused God? Nothing. God's his own self-caused. He's the uncaused cause. Nothing caused God to come to be. Well, what caused me to throw the marker at Heidi? Well, I gave you the reason, but what caused you to use that reason? Nothing. It stops there. It stops with reasons. So let's go back to Lucifer again. Lucifer chose to exalt himself above God. He chose to be one who was going to stand above God because he wanted to be worshipped. He decided that he was going to be worshipped. But why did he do that? Because he chose to. What was his reasons? Well, you could give reasons. You could say, well, because by doing that, perhaps he thought that this would be better for him in some way. You could give countless reasons, but the point is, why did Lucifer choose those reasons to do that act? It stops there. It stops there. It's ridiculous to try to go on and ask a further question. Yes, but why did... No, it stops there. That's what it means to have free will. It means you can choose your own reasons for accomplishing the ends that you've decided to choose. Having free will means you get to choose the reasons for accomplishing the ends that you choose. To go back and then say, okay, but what caused that? That's not a question. That's like asking, what color does green smell like? It's a category mistake, you know? Green doesn't smell like anything. I mean, there's green things that smell, but green itself doesn't smell like anything. That's a category mistake question. What caused a free will choice? Well, you caused a free will choice, but what caused you to cause a free will? Nothing. It stops there, you see. That's what it means. That's what the gift of free will is. Because you see, then, if you started saying, well, what caused me to do this was that, well, then what caused that? Well, this caused that. What caused that? This caused that. Well, now we're into determinism. Everything would be determined instead of free. There would be no free will if you kept going back and back. It has to stop somewhere for it to truly be a free choice. That's how evil came to be. It originated with Satan. But, you know, I think sometimes we give too much blame on Satan. It's like whenever something bad happens, oh, yeah, well, Satan, he caused me to do that. No, sometimes it's just you, okay? Sometimes it's just you. You just did it. It's not always his fault. I mean, he does enough bad stuff, but sometimes it's just our fault. And it doesn't matter whether, in my view, it doesn't matter whether Satan ever existed or not, there still would have been a fall. Okay, it wasn't, the people didn't fall because of Satan. He was just the tempter. Satan didn't need anybody to fall. He fell on his own. Why? Because he had free will. He can choose to do that if he wants. A third of the angels chose the same thing, but two-thirds didn't choose that, did they? Two-thirds chose. So you can go back and say, okay, well, why would a third choose? Well, I could give you all the reasons. I don't know what the reasons are, but you could speculate. Let's go back. Let's look at Adam now. Adam chose to disobey God. Why? God said, Adam, you can do anything you want in this garden, anything, basically, whatever, except there's one thing I don't want you to do, just one little thing, no big deal, right? Just don't eat this from this tree. The one little thing. Why? Oh, because he saw that there might be something missing here. Well, there might be something. God might not have told me something. So, I'm going to decide now to not trust him, that is God. I'm deciding he's not trustworthy, and so now I'm going to act contrary to the way that he told me. So he chose to act in a way contrary to God. He could have chosen not to. Every free will decision you make, you could choose not to do that thing. As a matter of fact, I'll go so far as to say, you don't have to sin at all. You don't have to sin. You don't have to. Take any particular sin case. Are you like a robot sinning, determined you can't not do it? No. We don't sin because we're robots. We sin because we choose to. We choose to. And God is saying, I want you to choose not to. I want you to choose to trust me. That's the very thing he's wanted from the very beginning, you see. He's wanted from the very beginning for people. Lucifer, the angels, Adam and Eve, people, us, you, me. What does he want from us? He wants us just to trust him. Trust him. Trust and obey, for there's no other way. That's the idea. Because, see, when you trust somebody, then you'll do what they say. But people decide that they won't. And you can give countless reasons why people will decide they won't. Countless reasons, but reasons are not determinative causes. Okay, we can take a mental break now for a second. Let's just stop here for a few minutes and let me process here with you and see how this is going. Is this clear? Is this confusing? Do you have thoughts, comments, questions, concerns? Let me hear what you have to say. Yeah.
So it's a little early in the process for me to even have good questions, but what will someone that is familiar with your argument say against it?
Well, there are different ways somebody could go here in responding to this kind of... I'll repeat the question. Thank you. He said, what might somebody say who disagrees with this argument? What might somebody say in response? Most atheists, at least atheists who have thought about this issue, deny free will. most atheists deny free will. Why is that? Well, it's a long, complicated story, but the simple version is that if all we are material entities, you know, bodies and brains, if that's all we are, then everything in the physical world seems to be caused by something else. If we're just physical things, then it seems like everything that happens has a prior cause, which has a prior cause, which has a prior cause, and so on. And so since everything has a prior cause, there is no place for free will, and so they'll deny the idea that there even is such a thing as free will. If you affirm free will, then this argument seems to be pretty powerful and persuasive. Other comments, questions? Yes.
How do you answer the question that since God chose to give the gift of free will, knowing that that free will is going to result in death and suffering and cruelty, does that not make him cruel?
Ah, that's a good question. So her question was, how can we respond to the idea that since God foreknew that this would happen, that people would choose to do evil and that cruelty and suffering and so on would be brought into the world, how can we say that God himself isn't cruel and so on? And there are a number of answers. I mean, one of the growing answers among some evangelical Christians is called open theism, which I think is false. But the idea is that God doesn't know the future, and so he didn't know that. He took a risk. Okay? Now, I've actually written a paper that's going to be published in a book I'm doing with Norman Geisler on this topic called Open Theism. So I think that's a false explanation. But there are, just so you know, there are some Christians who are taking that position now in seminaries and colleges and Bible schools and so on. So I think it's problematic for lots of reasons. I go into biblical reasons, historical reasons, philosophical reasons, theological reasons. There's all kinds of reasons why that's a problem. But just so you know, that's one. A second thing I would say is basically I would bring back in the arguments and evidences that I used from the first talk and lots of other ones, some of which I get into in my Building Belief book, that there are reasons why God would have done this that in eternity make it worth it. From an eternal perspective, all the suffering and pain and evil that's happened will have been worth it. Now, again, I can't go back through all of the reasons so on I gave, but let me just make this minor point, which I touched on in the first talk as well. The average person, say, lives somewhere between, say, 60 and 75 years, right? Think of a person who's lived the most horrendous, horrific 75 years imaginable. Thankfully, most people don't live 75 years of horror. Usually, real horror lasts a short time. Not always, but usually. But let's just say, let's take our worst case example. Somebody's lived 75 years of torture and horror. Okay? Now, what is 75 years compared to eternity? Now, this might seem like a pat answer, but I want you to just think about this for a minute. Okay? Just think about it. Think of some beach that you've been to. Think of a beach. I'll think of some beach on Naples, Florida, where I was recently. Think of all the grains of sand on that beach. All the grains of sand. I mean, think about it. Okay, imagine yourself picking up a handful of sand, looking at the grains, pulling out one tiny, tiny little grain of sand. That tiny little thing right there. Okay, now that's so small compared to your handful of sand, isn't it? Well, how small is that compared to the whole sand on that beach? How small is that compared to all the beaches in the world and planet Earth? That's not even a drop in the bucket compared to eternity. Can you fathom that? So even if you had 75 years of the most horrific, terrible, atrocious life, that compared to all of eternity being in a glorious heaven would be nothing. Now, it doesn't seem like nothing when we're there. I grant you that. It doesn't seem like nothing when we're there. But from an eternal perspective, it's a drop in the bucket. Not even that. So I think sometimes we've got to try to put ourselves in a different perspective. I mean, we're so caught up in what's happening to us right now, this very minute. We're so caught up in that. this very moment, or this year. I mean, by the way, I'm not trying to put blame or accuse anybody of anything. I go through this, obviously, myself. We all do. I mean, we get caught up in, oh, this is so bad. I remember when I was in graduate school, my wife and I were struggling financially. Oh, this is just terrible. You know, that wasn't that long ago. And I'm like, oh, life is fantastic. Forgot all about it, you know. And that went on for a couple of years. And obviously, it wasn't that atrocious, but yeah.
So I'm not going to say I believe this necessarily, but let's just say that play devil's advocate.
Nope, pun intended, I hope.
Right. So there is a psychology in conditioning, let's say. So maybe I make the argument that you have a group of people who you never feed anything, you have a locker room, you have another group of people, you feed lots of good food. So statistically, you might argue that they all have the free choice to cannibalize each other or get angry or not. But statistically, you'd probably argue that the people who had this certain set of experiences would be more likely. Where does the free will thing fit into the statistical likelihood that someone will do something without being
reversed? That's a very good question. How does free will fit into all this, and aren't there a lot of other factors involved? So aren't there factors of conditioning, factors of psychosis, I mean, all kinds of factors that could be involved in our decisions. And I totally grant that, and I'm not trying to deny that that's the case. As a matter of fact, even with this young man who did all these shootings, okay, did he do that purely out of free will, or what was going on? I mean, we don't know exactly what was going on. Did he have such a terrible psychological disorder that he was out of his mind? We don't know exactly, do we, all the time about these kind of things. We don't know when an act was purely free, or when it was partly free, or when it was totally determined by some other factors. Those kinds of things, we can't always figure that out. I completely grant that. That's why I'm glad we're not in the business of making decisions about eternal destinies and all that kind of thing, right? I mean, God's in the business of doing that. He knows where we are in this. He knows when we're making free decisions and when we're not. He knows what kind of social factors, cultural factors, genetic factors, other things. He knows when that's going on. Since we're on that, let me get off on another related but hot potato topic. Let's take a homosexuality. Could there be genetic factors? Could there be social factors in homosexuality? I think there very well could be. And I think it's kind of dangerous when Christians say, oh, there's completely nothing genetic going on here. Nothing at all whatsoever, absolutely. How do you know that? Okay, but the point isn't, could there be genetic influences? Because I think possibly there could be. The question is, what choices are you going to make given those genetic influences? See, we're all caught up in the fall. We all have genetic dispositions, even, I would say, to do certain things that we shouldn't be doing. One problem that men often have is lusting. There's some genetic stuff going on there. Does that mean you're off the hook? No, right? Jesus says, don't do it. Okay, we have tendencies, we have influences. There could well be genetic influences to alcoholism, genetic influences to, I don't know, child pornography, genetic influences to homosexuality. But the point isn't, are there genetic influences? The point is, what are you doing with those influences? What choices are you making in life? See, some people have an easier time in some area than other people. And that person might have an easier time and not struggle with something in that area. We've all got struggles. The question is, what are we going to do with them? And fortunately, God is the ultimate judge of these things. He knows what's going on in our hearts. He knows. He knows. And so he's the one that makes the final decision about what we're doing. Yes? So the question is, does this lead to the idea that God values relationship above all things? I think I would put it slightly differently. I think I would say God loves goodness and love above most things. Goodness and love. Love is the ultimate. God is love. The Bible says that. God is love. If you want to sort of get at the essence of God, I would say, then get at the essence of love. The essence of God is love. He loves to love. He loves to love. And he wants other people to be able to experience his love and each other's love and their love. But you can't do that without freedom. And that's the ultimate thing. And love is better than non-love. So, yeah. Yes, God knows that everybody is going to sin, but nobody has to sin. That's a very good question, by the way. Because at first glance, it might seem like, well, wait a minute, if God knows that everybody is going to sin, that means everybody has to sin. No, everybody doesn't have to sin. And there's no particular point where you have to sin. But he knows that you did, and he knows that you're probably going to. But you don't have to. You don't have to. And he's inviting us to change. As a matter of fact, I'm going to be speaking, I think, at church either here or there, one of the churches tomorrow. I'm going to be speaking on this very point about Jesus wanting us to live a life of holiness and some of the kinds of things that are helpful for us to be practicing in our lives so that we don't have to be sinning, because he doesn't want us to sin. Yes?
Kind of springboarding off her question about the God creating people and he knew they were going to do this and all of that, and your answer, to me, a logical conclusion that a non-believer would say is that, well, then, but yeah, that's in light of eternity, that's all well and good, but a Christian's own Bible would say that narrow is the path to life and wide is the path to destruction, so why would a loving God create this whole thing where the vast majority of people are going to live in that eternity in destruction or torment?
Yeah, did everybody hear the question? So why did God create a world in which so many people are going to live in torment and destruction? Wide is the gate that leads to destruction, narrow is the path. Well, for one thing, let me just say this, and again, I'm not taking this position per se, I'm just opening it up as a possibility, and you might agree or disagree, you can explore this yourself, but there are a number of commentators who take that narrow is the gate and wide is the gate passage, not as saying, therefore these people are going forever to eternal damnation. Okay, but that's just the easier path for people to follow. I don't think it necessarily has to mean that more people are in hell than not. But it very well could be. But even if that's the case, I would make this point. Suppose God is looking out and he's saying, okay, let's take three people, person A, person B, and person C. And I know person A is going to choose to follow me, and I know person B and C is going to choose to not follow me. Well, I think I just won't make person B and C then. See, I don't think that's the loving thing to do. Just because somebody is not going to follow you and do what you say, I would argue, is not a reason to not create them. See, God could have just created people who would just follow him. But see, then you have a loaded dice here, don't you? What kind of person would only make people who do exactly what they want?
How would that glorify God?
Right. So I would say that, so since we're getting into potentially heretical territory, let me make another point. I agree with Dallas Willard on something, and feel free to completely disagree with this. Dallas Willard says, hell is God's best for some people. Okay, now before you throw stones, just think about that just for a minute. Hell is God's best for some people. What does that mean? That means, at least as I take this myself, as I understand this, God created hell not primarily for persons, primarily for the devil and his minions, and he didn't want to create it for them. But see, God wasn't going to force anybody to love him, because forced love isn't love. Forced love is rape, and God is not a cosmic rapist. God is not a cosmic rapist. He's not going to force anybody to love him. He's going to give people the choice. And in order to give people a true choice, He has to let them choose to follow him or not. And so he had to make a place where people would go that don't want to follow him, and that's what hell is. Hell is a place where people go who will not follow God. Okay? It's separation from God, and it's bad, obviously, because being away from God is bad. But God can't make those people freely choose to follow him. He could make them follow him if he wanted. God can do whatever he wants. He could turn them into robots and make them love him all day long. But you see, that would be forcing them to love him, and forced love isn't love. So to really love people, he had to create a hell. Do you see that? There had to be a hell. Because what else are you going to do with those people? You're just going to snuff them out of existence? There are some Christians. By the way, John Stott is one of them. John Stott is a Christian pastor and theologian in England. He's written a number of things. He's an evangelical. But on this view, he disagrees with the history of the church. He says God is going to just snuff out those people. Is that love? Oh, you're not going to follow me? Zap. There, you disintegrated. That doesn't seem like love. No, love is letting people go who don't want you. If you're in high school or college, say, or out of college or out of high school, whatever, and you're dating somebody and they say, I don't love you anymore. Yes, you're going to love me forever. And what is that? No, God doesn't do that. I'm so sorry we are out of time here, but I'll be here around in the next session. I'll do more time of a discussion if you want to do that, or I'll just be around to talk about it. So thank you for your patience. Thank you for your good comments and questions, and blessings to you. Yes, sir.
Like non-believers, they don't acknowledge this concept, and all they say is they look at from their they don't understand about what I'm saying is like they only say like why is God up there, why is this happening, and that's their common trademark. They always say like why, and they don't really think about going to the original sin. They don't think about following them. They don't realize all the bad things they do, but they only see that point in their life.
That's a good point. Yeah. And that's why it's helpful for us to point that out.
But how do you get to the person see the perspective the way we see, because they are already biased and confused? So, you're trying to show me your belief.
That's the task of apologetics. That's why you slowly